Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away, so it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Welcome back to Cutting the Distance. I met today's guest in my booth at the Pacific Northwest Sportsman Show probably 8-9 years ago. He was a quiet guy. He didn't say a whole lot. He was kind of sitting in the corner, and I knew he was good at long range hunting, and I was kind of getting into it, so I kind of forced him to talk to me. That's not exactly how it goes. He's a great guy, just very, very quiet. And I was getting more into my rifles, you know, my loads, figuring out how to get all my equipment dialed, and he was a great resource. So John Pinch is my guest today. I don't know, he's too humble to probably tell you how many, but I know he's won hundreds of shooting events between the NRL, PRS, and other shooting events. When he's not shooting, he seems to be traveling on some pretty kick-ass big game hunts across the country. He'd want to be better known as a family man. I know he's got two kids, you know, a wife that they spend a lot of time with. And so welcome to the show, John.
Yep, thanks for having me, Jason. It's good to talk with you. I don't know if I spend a lot of time at home because I'm gone so much, but yeah, my wife and kids are awesome.
Yeah. How's everything going?
Yeah, no, it's been going good. Been pretty busy, traveling a lot the last, like November, December was real busy. So it's actually been really laid back. Just past New Year's here, had a pretty fun Christmas, been hanging out with the boys and just laying low, working on some stuff at the house. It feels pretty good. So kind of revamping, getting ready for this next year, making some plans for business and shooting. And I've done landscaping for a long time, kind of phasing out of that slowly, but I think this year is looking pretty good to hopefully wrap that up and continue to focus more on the shooting side of things. So it's going good.
So that's a great segue, John. Like, what does a typical year for you look like as far as hunting versus shooting? Like what's a year in your life look like?
Yeah, I fly by the seat of my pants a little bit more than some of my buddies, where they plan out their whole year. Starting in probably, let's see, end of this month, January, the shoots start kicking off. NRL Hunter and PRS, which is the Precision Rifle League or Precision Rifle Series. And there's shoots all over U.S., Canada, you know, went to South Africa this year to shoot one. There's some in Norway. They're all over. So pretty much you could shoot almost every weekend, especially through the spring and early summer. The heat of the summer kind of moves some of the matches around. Like generally there's not a lot of Arizona matches in the middle of the summer and stuff like that. So I usually am kind of, if I have an open weekend, you know, there's not a big family event, or, you know, I try to get to the kids' baseball tournaments and stuff as much as possible. But as long as I got an open weekend, I'm usually booking a flight somewhere and hitting a shoot somewhere. So I need to shoot as much as I can. Hunting trumps competition. So the last couple of years, we had hunts booked over the Precision Rifle Series finale. That took a little wind out of my sails for really hitting the season hard, knowing I couldn't shoot the championship. So I shot 3-4 matches instead of, you know, 8 to 12, or some guys are shooting 15, 18 matches a year, which is a lot. That's a lot of flights, a lot of travel, getting guns ready and everything. So, I try to shoot as many shoots as I can, schedule permitting, and hopefully I'm doing more in the next few years, the way some of my schedule's changing. But then hunting trumps all that. So some of our hunts, we've got dates booked and planning for next year. Other ones, we try to keep a pretty loose schedule, and we've hit multiple cancellation hunts the last few years. Just went up to Kodiak last minute, just on a DIY thing a few weeks ago. That's when you, I think you initially texted me, you do a podcast. It's like, I'm heading out on a plane tomorrow to a little drop camp. So I was trying to kill a Sitka blacktail. So,
there you go.
But yeah, kind of some of that stuff's just, like I said, last minute, but that's kind of the way schedule looks. I'm still working, got family, kids, we got baseball, we got, you know, fun stuff going on like that too. So.
Gotcha. So real busy. You could shoot as much as you want. And then do you tend to focus on PRS more so, or NRL, or do you have to hit like a certain amount of events to qualify? Like how do you juggle that as well? Like there's all these different events, or maybe just like, you know, single events. Like how do you play the game?
I mean, it's kind of personal preference. I've done NRL Hunter probably a little more. I wanted to, in NRL Hunter, there's a open class, which your gun can weigh 16 pounds or less. So you can run whatever you want up to 16 pounds. There's light class, which is 12 pounds or less. There's factory, which they have a list of factory rifles. You can't mod them at all. You take it out of the box, Atika, Bergara, whatever their list is. And then there's teams where you, two guys can sign up and shoot teams. And I wanted to be the first one that won every class. So take an open gun and win the overall shoot, not just first in that class. Take a light gun and win the entire shoot. And then take a factory gun and beat all the custom rifle guys for the entire shoot, and then do it in teams. And so I actually shot NRL Hunter a fair bit because I did that. So that was kind of just an internal goal of mine. Yeah. And so that's what I did more. So I think I shot 4 PRS matches last year, 5, and ended up shooting. I was able to shoot the finale this year. I got 6th at the finale. So it was good. It's the top 250 guys. And so I had a good match, but I had one bad stage that, it takes nothing to drop a few spots. So it's, there's some killers though. There's a bunch of really good, I have a really good friends in that group, and some guys that are super dedicated to it. So, I kind of ebb and flow. Like this year I want to hit PRS a little bit more. It's heavy, more purpose-built guns, where NRL Hunter is more hunting type of guns, where the PRS is, you know, you're shooting a 20 pound, you know, 6.65, 25 cal gun, not much recoil, lots of movement, real fast shooting, which I'm real good at. But it's the pinnacle of shooting. Like it is the best shooters in the world.
Yeah.
And I want to shoot that more just because it makes me better. NRL Hunter is a different, it combines glassing, position building. It combines a lot of different elements that I love. But just purely shooting, PRS is difficult. It's tough.
Cause there's target acquisition in NRL. Like you have to spot your target, get your own, you know, all of that, which adds into the game. So I want to rewind just a little bit. You would never say this, but it was internally in your head. You basically took a gun that you could buy off of a shelf and then went and beat some shooters shooting the best, most fancy guns that you could build.
I did barely, but I did. Yeah.
So I mean, you would, like I said, you're very, you know, modest, humble, but that just kind of, for all the listeners, lets you into kind of how good John is, and he'll never say it, but I mean, to take a gun that's literally a stock gun and beating, you know, custom rifles, it kind of just hints to how good you are behind a gun, and you know, your dedication, your time, you know, you're always shooting, always reloading, always tinkering, and so it goes a long ways to kind of just explain, you know, the level that you're at. And so I think that's worth stating. So we're gonna jump into some into some listener questions now, like we always do. These are a couple question and answers we've pulled from social media. If you have questions for me or my guests, please email them to us at ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com or hit us up on a social media message or a social post. So our first question today comes from Tyson Lundahl. How do you go about judging for wind down range and over terrain features? And I know this is probably like the trickiest part of everything we're going to talk about later. You know, like there isn't wind on your ridge. What are the signs or what are you picking out there to make your wind call? Which I don't know your answer, but I'm going to assume that, up and down is pretty easy for the most part, but left and right is where the whole game and the art comes in. But go ahead and explain like what you can use to figure out when.
Yeah. So, I mean, so there's the art and the science of long range shooting, and wind is the art, right? It's never fixed. You're never on a flat plane. There's ups, there's downs, there's lefts, there's rights, there's eddies, there's box canyons that swirl. So there's the science, you know, there's a lot of data, there's a lot of ballistic calculators, there's a lot of things that do a really good job with crosswind jump and every variable you can imagine. And then there's the art of it. And so there isn't a hard and fast answer. You pretty much, you look at anything you can get. If there's grass, if there's trees, if there's anything in the air, if there's rain, if there's fog, anything that you can see, you take into account, obviously. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer. Some people say, oh, you watch terrain when water rolls. And yeah, that's good, but that doesn't also cover, water doesn't roll uphill. And so if there's a big updraft, like, I don't know. Like, so I've had some big updrafts. If I'm on a valley, I'm up here, I'm shooting over here. It's actually more if I'm up here and this is a long valley running out and there's like kind of hills on this, you know, here and here, and there's a valley coming at you and the wind's coming at you. If I'm shooting across to those with a strong wind in your face, I'll get a big updraft on this hill. That wind's ripping up this hill. And it'll hold my bullet up. And so those are all things that are so hard to take into account. It kind of leads into another, I think the most important thing that you can do as a shooter, and it changed a lot of my, I don't know, philosophy is the right word, but gun build choice, weights, calibers, so I can spot my own shot. You have to see where your bullet lands. And a lot of guys don't. A lot of guys shoot, the recoil's gone, they rely on their buddy. And if they're solo, they're out of luck. They shoot and they hope they hit it. And if you can spot your shots, stuff happens. You can make a bad wind call. You can do anything. But if you can spot your shot, generally, you can measure that and make a quick correction and get a second round impact.
Yep.
That's not ideal. I'm just saying there's stuff happens and no one's ever right 100% of the time on wind. And so if I'm on a canyon and it's calm where I'm at, generally you can hear wind or you can see wind. You know something's going on. If it's that far, if you're two canyons away, generally you're talking like 1,000+ yards, depending on the terrain. I'm going to recommend cutting the distance. I'm not the long range guy. I've shot as much as anybody or more, and I'm never the guy that's backs up to another 100 yards. So I shoot 1,000 instead of 900, and I'm not going to post that on social. We made a lot of long shots. I'm never going to, people ask how far. I just don't say. There's elements of long range shooting that I love it, but I also hate the social media killed this at 1400 yards with one shot. I was like, well, you couldn't do that. If we went out and on steel, you'd miss that steel a lot. I know you would, because I've shot more than you. Yeah. Not to sound arrogant, but yeah. it's hard. No. And so you take anything. I mean, generally you can hear wind, you can see it. Especially evergreen trees are real easy to read. Big fir trees, you can see the direction the wind's hitting. The backside of the tree is relatively calm. The front, the branches are kind of peeling around. And then it's just experience. Hey, is that a 7 over there? Is that a 15 mile an hour? And then if it's dead for 300 yards, you don't have wind until you hit 400 and 500 yards. So you can, we're getting a little deep here for a podcast, but you can, you can run your brackets out. Like when you shoot a bullet, the biggest deflection is right out of your gun. If you take a bullet off course out of the muzzle, it's going to be way off course downrange. If it doesn't go off course till 300 or 400 yards, if you're protected along a clear cut tree line, or it's just, you're in the bottom and it doesn't get into the wind until you shoot out the top, then you're cutting your wind drift down. The first 400 yards don't see wind, and maybe the last 300 yards see a 15 mile an hour. So you can kind of break that down into brackets of what it's going to do. Yep. All that comes from experience. I wish I had like this really good answer. You do this, this, and this. It doesn't exist. It's an art. It comes from a lot of practice. and taking everything into account. What I see a lot of guys do is the moment happens, it's quick. Half the times they forget to dial something or what, just they don't level their gun. Go through your checklist. Make sure your range is perfect. These are no-brainer things. Make sure your level is perfect. Take a second to slow down and make a really good thought process on wind. Study the trees. Study the cobwebs floating. Anything you can see. And don't be afraid to hold wind. In the comp world, we talk about like missing on the pro side. So beginners always miss downwind. They never hold enough wind. And so missing on the pro side would be missing upwind. If I'm going to miss a plate, I want to miss upwind because you rarely overjudge wind. It's just like a natural tendency. People get scared to hold that much.
Hold that far
so,
off.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things we could, you know, we could talk about this forever, but I think just slow down and be very aware. If you're not comfortable, cut distance. Generally, if you're looking over a couple canyons, you can get to the next ridge.
Like, yep.
Just cut the distance, get to 600, 700 yards.
Yep. And one of the things, so, you know, especially on wind that I like to do is in my ballistic calculator, if I think it could be a 5, but then it could be a 10, I want to go look at the difference. Like how much error is in my, mm-hmm. my calculation. And if it's more than what's acceptable at that range, then I need to get closer, you know? And so it's like, yep. how confident am I that this is a 5 or a 10, or yep. is it, if it's only 500 yards, it's not going to matter. Right. But if I'm taking a shot that's 700 or 800 and it starts to move that bullet an extra, you know, whatever it might be, I'm like, well, yep. that's not ethical, you know, in my opinion, then I need to get closer yep. or not take the shot. And so I do a lot of that. Like, here's my envelope. I think it could be as low as 3, yeah. it could be as high as 10. Yeah. And then like, where does that move my bullet? And can I compensate for that? Am I still going to hit vitals if I'm at either end? And can I, you know, split that? Yep. And yep. like you say, it's all an art, what you're comfortable with. And I'm going to go, this is kind of a good segue yes. to our next question from Charlie Smith, who's my buddy, my good time hunting partner.
Oh, Charlie. You guys' banter online is always gold.
Oh yeah. And this banner kind of comes into this question where it's stuff that we all yeah. talk about behind the scenes, but when you don't want to necessarily knock long range hunting. But so Charlie Smith's question is, do you think long range rifles are ruining hunting? Which is a fair question.
Yeah.
And when you say yeah. ruining hunting, is it ruining our season, shortening them? Is it taking too many animals? But like, what's your opinion on that? Because it is something that I feel like we should have to be able to answer if you're going to shoot. And then the other thing is, what is 100%. Long range hunting defined as, which I don't even want to get into yeah. right now. But like, in your opinion, is this whole long range movement, is it affecting hunting and to what degree?
Yeah. I mean, I don't understand how you could say it's not. How is technology not? I mean, when I started archery, I mean, I shot archery for years. Years ago, a 40, 50 yard shot was a tough shot. Now my bow's got a slider and you can stack arrows at 100 yards. Like it's, and you look at muzzle loaders, right? You look at these crazy muzzle loaders that are shooting smokeless powder. Some of the states, I mean, I think those rules are changing, but yeah. there's muzzle loaders 500, 600, 700 yards, you know? And so, yeah, absolutely. More animals are dying. People are getting better at hunting. There's so much information like this podcast and many others and internet forums. So yeah, I think it is. I think states, I think I worry about a lot. Hunting, I've had the opportunity to go on some high-end hunts that are out of my budget because of a buddy I have, and experience both sides of the thing. I mean, I grew up over-the-counter hunting. I live in Western Oregon, grew up in Western Washington. So we're hunting rosies and blacktails, parked at a trailhead, which used to be 3 or 4 trucks. Now it's 10 or 20.
Yep.
And so we all see the same thing. I see how money is affecting opportunity big time. It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It just is what it is. And hunting is, yeah, killing stuff with a rifle is easier than it used to be. I think, unfortunately, fish and game departments get funding from tag sales, and they're not going to cut numbers. And I wish they would.
Yeah,
I think there needs to be less opportunity. I mean, you look at Arizona and the way they look at hunting. I got a lot of buddies down there. Like, they apply their whole life and they hunt with other people because they draw every 5, 10, 15 years. But they hunt every year with a group just because tags are so hard to get. I don't like that, but there's the reality of supply and demand, quality. And it's also a different value. Some guys like to go out and shoot a forked horn. I love the idea of finding a big buck. So I wish there were, you know, I wish there needs to be less tags in some areas. Yeah. I mean, it's a sticky, people are going to get fired up. But yeah, I think it does. It makes it easier. In some ways, I don't like the guys, I already mentioned this, that are like puffing their chest up because they shot so far. The braggadocious of that kind of stuff bugs me. But it happens in everything. Oh, I shot this at 55 yards with my trad bow. I shot this at 120 with my compound. I shot this at 500 with a muzzle loader. And I shot this at 1500 with a center fire. It's the same thing across the board. Everyone's getting better. Everyone's getting deadlier and technology's incredible. So, I mean, I don't know what the answer is.
No, I think we both know. And then I'm on the side where, we've got, and I should be careful to put myself in the same boat as you, but like we have the ability to shoot like long range, but I take more pride in that I snuck into that buck at 150, or 100. I had a long range rifle, but I was still hunting, and it seems like you just have the skills necessary to take the long range shot if you need to, or a follow-up shot. But, I just see a trad guy kill at 5 yards, or a compound guy kill at 10, whether they can shoot at 100 or not is a different story. But to me, that's the challenge.
100%. I mean, we all want to be ethical and competent. I loved archery hunting. I shot more bulls and deer with I've shot more elk with a bow than I have with a gun and shot quite a few deer. And I liked it because it was challenging. Back in the day, I'd sight in my whatever I was shooting with, my 30-06 from 300 Win Mag or whatever. And then I was done. I was like, it's not fun to shoot that gun at 200 yards. And so I was geeking out on the archery side and then found out about long range a long time ago. And it just was interesting. It was fun. It was challenging again. It was fun to make wind calls. It was fun to learn that art of it. And so, then I started hunting that way and it is fun. I mean, this year, pretty short kills. I killed a big white, my biggest whitetail at 65 yards. I was working these does and it was in this thick stuff. I just worked in on it. And then, shot my Sitka at a couple hundred, 250. Just a lot of closer range stuff this year. Is it easy? I think it's easier to shoot an animal at 400 to 600 yards than it is at 50 to 100 most of the time. Cause it's calm. I'm prone. Like I'm not going to miss that shot. I don't know. I mean, it is a debate and I totally get it. I'm not one that's going to defend it. I don't like when guys pick sides like compound guys or muzzleloader guys. We're all doing the same thing. It's the sport's changing. It's been weird the last 3 years watching the money and everything change. And it's all of it. It's social media, it's everything, but it is changing quick. It'll be interesting to see where it goes.
I think that if we're going to be willing to do it, we just have to accept, or like you said, make changes like Arizona, that our seasons may shorten because our take's going to be higher. We're going to, because of some of these things and technology advancements, but then I don't want to be a hypocrite and say that we shouldn't have them because I'm also using them, because otherwise if you don't have the ability, you're behind everybody. And so I think it's just a personal decision. I like the art and the science and the nerdiness behind it and getting a setup that you're just like, super confident in. For me, like 500 yards, like I'm going to put this bullet inside of a 2-inch circle at 500. Like no question. Where before, growing up, I had a 3x9 loophole, very X2, where you're like, oh, just aim to the post. That's all you ever heard on those duplexes. Like, 500, no matter what gun, no matter what caliber. And then
put it on the back. My gun shoots so fast. I put it on the back to 1,000 yards.
And then the one thing that really drives me nuts, and I'm going to throw some of my own family under the bus, because they had custom guns built because we were out doing it and maybe taking longer shots. And, I can, like my dad, you get like 10 bullets down the barrel and be like, all right, build my dope chart and show me how to dial this thing, And I'm like, well, I don't know if like you don't have a coach there or like understanding all this. And like my uncle going on a deer hunt this year, like he never chronoed it. He went off of like somebody else's load data for a different gun. Oh, and then like, I should be good. He's like, I should be good like 800, right? With this. I'm like, no, you don't, like you haven't confirmed anything besides a starting point,
It's the same guys that get their gun bore sighted at Sportsman's the night before season and think they're ready to go hunt. And it's the same guys that buy a bow the week before season. So it's the same mentality.
There are guys out there
don't care. We don't geek out like we do.
Yeah. And they think that just buying the equipment gets them there, And it's like, no, there's a lot more to this. And so I'll diverge. 100%, I know Charlie brought that up more as a joke, but it's something that we talk about. And when we say ruining hunting, I wouldn't say it's ruining it, but it's definitely affecting it in a
it's changing
way. Yep.
I mean, but what is it? Like, how has Onyx not changed it? How is everything we do, like the application services and mapping and everything? I mean,
or easier
everything's
to use calls.
Changing it.
Yeah. I mean, you could throw you could throw us under the bus, like easier it's to everybody. Use calls. So now you have more people that can use. And so, yeah, I mean, I'd be hypocritical to say this, but it's just something I think is a general group of people, you know, hunters, we just have to think about and make good decisions moving forward.
I think just being aware of it, having the discussion, everyone's using technology, the better. Trucks are farther, hunting gear's lighter, you can go in deeper, you stay drier, you stay warmer. Everything we do, nutrition is lighter. Peak put 40 grams of protein instead of 10 like Mountain House used to. Everything's better, right? So you can do I think the discussion and just to be aware, you can't get mad about it, but I think you got to be open to potential tag cut numbers and being not drawn as much. I think that's ultimately where we need to go. I don't know that we'll do that because fishing games relying on the sales. We'll see. And then now we got wolves.
Yeah. We won't get into
that's
that
one. Actually long range. It's just in case I see a wolf.
There's
no ethical distance for a wolf. So take that.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land? Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
So this one may just pertain to long range, and I'll let you put the parameters on it. So when do you take, and this comes from my buddy Cody Wilson out of Wyoming, when do you look at things like azimuth and bullet, like spin drift? Like, when do those things come into play? Is that only when you're looking at like really long range? And maybe explain azimuth for people that, you know, don't understand.
For Coriolis, yeah. If you take a heading that generally referring to Coriolis effect, the rotation of the earth. I mean, that's, I would say, I don't want to say never, but pretty much never. That's not going to affect anything. Spin drift, absolutely. I mean, you'll get, for sure have your Spindrift on in your calculators. If you're zeroed, almost all barrels are right twist, which means if your zero is dead on left to right, you're going to hit right at distance because your bullet's rolling to the right. So yes, absolutely use that. Spindrift is going to be, it depends on the caliber and the twist, you know, it can be 4, 5, 6 inches of 1,000, plus or minus, and it's definitely moving your bullet. So yes, do Spindrift, Coriolis or your azimuth, not near as important. I'd say in hunting distances, it's irrelevant.
Okay. Irrelevant.
That would be my opinion. Some people may argue that, but I don't really know anybody that would argue that a whole lot. Yeah. So,
And I might misquote you. I know at one time you had actually told me to sight my gun in at 100 a little bit to the left to kind of account for that out to what I would consider my hunting distances, right? And it kind of just Now you just said keep it on your calculator, which I don't want to discredit that at all. But for a guy like me that's not going to shoot at an animal unless it's a follow-up shot ever past 1,000, like I want to say we were like an inch, maybe inch and a quarter left at 100, which doesn't hurt me at 100, 200, 300. But
that's
then
a lot. I would never say that much. I'm usually, if I'm left, I'm shooting mils now. I shot MOA forever, bolter grade. I'm not going to go into a mils MOA discussion, but I shoot mils now because it's in the comp world and I do like a lot of aspects of it. I think there's some benefits to it in the hunting world as well. But so each click in a mil is roughly 0.33, 0.36, whatever. If I can't land on my zero, If I'm going to be either left or right of my zero point, I'm going to choose to go left, a little left. Yeah. I'm never going to go an inch left. That's a lot. Okay. I wouldn't say that, but if I'm going to choose either left or right, I'm going to choose left and just kind of have a mental note of that when I'm calculating Spindrift. And we're talking in the hunting world, you're right. It's not near as important. I mean, 5, 6 inches at 1,000, that's a chunk of, but you know, in your 300, 400, 500, 600, 700 yard range, you're talking a few inches, you're still in the vitals. It's going to be more of an issue judging the wind, than Spindrift. But if you're dead calm and like, I'm trying to shoot a 2-inch steel target at 600, 700 yards, if it's dead calm, you are going to miss right. Yeah. You're going to miss right. So you have to take that into account on tiny little skinny targets.
Yeah. And
so,
then I actually ended up avoiding the going left at all plans, which has probably saved me. It sounds like, cause that would have been too much. I just went back to zero and then like you have my Spindrift calculator on.
Yeah. I think that's the smartest.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back in the day, I mean, when I started, I'm kind of getting old now, I guess, but there wasn't Spindrift in calculators. There's everybody just knew like, oh, these bolts kind of go right, so I'm going to zero a little left. I mean, and then you just kind of had that mental note. So it's progressing. Like you get the new, like the Kestrel 5700 with applied ballistics. Like they've got crosswind jump and Spindrift. You got every calculation at Coriolis. They got everything in there. I mean, it's a, you know, and those apps are on your phone as well. Different things like that. So. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's going to kind of wrap it up for the listener questions. Once again, you have questions for us here at Cutting the Distance, please email them to us at ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com or send us a message and we'll do our best to get in. So now we're going to kind of jump into my discussion, on the guns and the equipment. But before we jump into those conversations about the guns and components, which everybody loves to talk about, right? Because you can control that with money. But you can't, but let's talk about what, in my opinion, really matters, and we'll see if you agree, is the things that you can't buy with money, you know, whether it's reading the wind, you know, the art of it, a bunch of trigger time, you know, hundreds of thousands of rounds. What defines a good long range hunter versus a guy that goes out and buys a $10,000 rifle? That equipment's no good if you don't have this other stuff. So what do people really 100%. Need to know in order to start pulling the trigger at long ranges or be effective when they do?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the list is super long. I think you need to be interested in it. It's got to be somewhat of a hobby. I think you could make the argument, and I do this. We train people and stuff. We take guys out that have more money than time. You know, some of these guys that go on pretty big hunts are, they're business guys that make a pretty good income. And so they don't have a lot of time to go shoot on the weekends and they're not going to travel around to comps. Their time's more valuable than that. So, and it's not their deal. So, you can make the argument that in that generally what was rifle shooting 300 yards and in type of a thing, 400 was a long shot. You could make the argument that 300 to 600 yards with a good setup gun and limited knowledge is nearly automatic. And so I talk with a lot of guys. It's like, man, I'd really like your limit to be in that 6-650 range, unless the wind is howling, and maybe less. I think when you get past that 500-600 yard range, you need to, it's got to be a hobby. You got to be interested. You got to shoot. You can't go out and shoot 4 or 5 rounds a year. Your form, your follow through, your trigger pull, everything is not going to be adequate to be ethical, you know, to make a 700 yard shot, even have the wherewithal to think about, okay, the thermals are coming down this hill, a little bit of left to right. I'm going to, you know, just all the basics to stay calm. In a situation, I see guys get so keyed up when they get in and they're getting ready to take a shot that all the thought process of the small things go away. And I think you can get that by shooting more. You go up in a clear cut and shoot. I tell guys to go up, take 5 rounds or 10 rounds and go shoot in a clear cut, shoot some rocks at, you know, 500 to 1,000 yards. And don't just shoot. Like, oh, I hit it. See if you can hit on the first round, or see if you can get real, real close, because that's all that matters. If you hit on your 5th round, it's irrelevant. Like the guys that shoot new world record at 4,200 yards and you shot 17 rounds. To me, it's, I guess the equipment's interesting to get a, you know, whatever. I don't want to, it seems dumb to me.
Like, yeah. I don't
close first round impacts.
I don't want to throw the L word around on that. You know, like you said, one shot finally hit at 17, but like, I don't want to say, and this is going to, I don't know if we have any extra, you know, fine. Extreme long range people here, but like at some point, like, you hit it 1 out of 17. Yeah. It's still a feat and you still accomplished something, but was there a little bit of luck involved finally that you didn't 100%. Hit it the last 16, you know? And so I just like you. And,
yeah. As a disclaimer, the world records are now, they're doing like 3 consecutive shots, cold bore plus 2 at 2,500 and 32. Like, that's impressive. Like, I'm not going to discredit that. We, you know, so anyway, disclaimer, world record thing is, to me, is stupid, but whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like growing up around here, what we considered long range growing up, you know, we have a pretty good range here where I grew up. You know, a lot of guys that were bench rest shooters here at the PL range, they would shoot at a target, maybe 100 yards off the deer or the elk that they wanted to shoot in a clear cut, get the wind right, and then they would bring their gun back over, which, just like you said, like you want to make that first shot kill. But maybe I don't want to bring up ethical or moral either, because if they're shooting 7, they know what their drift is based on this spot shot, and then a lot of times those deer elk wouldn't even get bothered by it, you know, with the muzzle brake or a can or whatever they may have. And so that's kind of how we grew up. That's what I thought long range shooting was, and then as I got into it, I'm like, no, I want to make the right corrections up front, and then I'll take my shot at the animal and then have a spotter and then make a correction if I need to. But
that's not a bad, as funny as that may sound to some people, that's not, if you're shooting at long range and you can't cut the distance and you trust your gear and stuff, it's not a bad idea to take a shot like that. If you can swing over, you got a rock face or something you can shoot 100-200 yards to left or right, that's, I don't want to discredit that at all. If you've got something funky, you're like, hey, I'm going to take a test shot. All right. Your wind call's on or it's off, make correction to kill the animal. Like, that is a decent idea to keep in your head if the conditions are real sporty.
Yep. No, that's how we do it.
I know what you're saying, though.
Yeah. There's an art to it where you want to, like, you don't want to, it's almost like you're using a cheat code, like on an old video game, right? You're like, I don't want that information. I just want to try to do it. But I also feel we owe it to the animals that if there's any doubt in your mind, you know, that this might not work out how you think it will, then that might be a good option is you know. And you had mentioned, and maybe you've changed, but like on a windy shoot or even a competition, you've maybe not waste one, but you may test to see what the wind is so you can clear the stage after that first shot. Is that, I thought I'd heard you once, like you used to do that, maybe that you would.
No, a misunderstanding. So the only time any of the top guys will do anything is if, and this is rare, I might have done it once ever, but I'm always trying to hit the target. The idea is to hit the target, read where you hit the target, move your impact to the center so you can stay in there as the wind changes. But every once in a while, there's a couple stages I wish I would have done this. You'll get maybe a skyline target at 800, 900 yards, where if you miss, you see nothing. And so you'll see guys go up there, they think they've got it, boom, miss. Now they're 3-4 misses deep. Where, so sometimes on a stage like that, you could put one in the dirt, like at the base of the tee post, and then go to the target. So you're dropping one shot instead of two, three, or four. Yeah. So on a skyline target, generally targets were usually somewhere where you can either see trace, or you see bullet trace going left or right, or you can see where the bullet actually lands.
Gotcha.
But it's a pretty rare occurrence when you would burn one in the dirt, but you could. There's been, yep. I think I've done it once.
I gotcha. Yep. So. Misunderstanding there, but yeah, that makes sense. Just, you know, try to spot your shot on the target and then make your adjustments. If you know, micro adjustments at that point, stay on or be center.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's get into the equipment, because it's what everybody wants to talk about.
Everybody wants to talk about gear.
Yeah. So like gun selection, where for me, I made the decision to hunt with multiple guns. So I've got a big long range gun that I don't like to pack around. I went with a kind of a do it all mountain rifle and 7 short action ultra mag, and then just recently got a 6.5 PRC, as it seems like some of these, you know, so that's kind of I either have a 338 Edge, I've got the 7 SOM, or I've got the 6.5 PRC now. When people are going in, you know, some random person going in, they're gonna get a long range gun built. What factors do you think should weigh into that gun? And then how do you go on about like starting with the caliber and then going from there?
So I've always been component first. I usually pick my bullet and build the gun around that. And I've been a big Burger bullet fan for a long, long time. I've recently actually shot some solids I'm liking, and we'll see, playing with some different things. But been a Burger bullet fan for a long, long time. So I'm the same as you. I have a 6.5 PRC. I like a 30 cal and a big 338. I haven't shot my big 338 near as much as I used to. Mostly I'm 6.5 and 30. But I kind of like the idea of, you know, a few different golf clubs in your bag. So for different hunts, different weights. Like, so I'm going to pick my bullet. If I want to shoot a 215 hybrid Burger, I'm going to kind of see, it's a 30 cal. I'm going to see, what do I want to shoot? Well, I want to shoot good brass. Generally, that's been Lapua the last handful of years. Now we have ADG. We've got Peterson. We've got Alpha. We've got some pretty good brass selections that aren't your typical. Norma was consistent, but it was soft. You know, then you got all your Hornady and Federal stuff that's not to the quality of some of the premium brass brands. So I'm going to pick my brass. So I'm going to go. Lately, it's been Lapua makes 300 Norma. 300 Norma has been really easy for me. Spot my shots good. Speeds are decent. I'm not a speed demon. Like a lot of guys are into horsepower. They're into fast cars. I get it. It's fun. But I am a slow and steady wins the race in the gun world. And it took a lot of shooting to get to that. And every guy that gets into comp shooting doesn't understand it until you shoot a while and you realize that the faster, crazier guns tend to be a little bit more finicky. So if I can run a 215 at 2950 to 3000, 3020, like I don't want to run at 3150. If it shoots great, I mean, you can, I'm not saying don't, but man, the consistency that I get out of 2950, 3000 is just day in and day out. It's not finicky. And so that's how I pick my gun. So then I pick my barrel twist around that. If I want to have a midweight gun, I like 30 cals in that 10 to 11 pound range, just because I want to spot my shots, like I talked about earlier. A good muzzle brake, 6.5 PRC. I like the 156 Burger a lot. And then, you know, ADG makes good brass. Lapua makes brass for it. And I'm going to run that gun in probably between an 8 to 10 pound gun, probably with a bipod, with everything on it. And I run a big scope. I'm not going to skimp on scope. That's the last thing I'm going to skimp on. And so those are kind of my weights. And that 8 to 10 pound is, I'm a 6.5, 10 to 12 is a 30, and then 12 or above, 12 to 16 is a 338, something big. So I think a lot of guys are moving to that kind of thing. It works really well. I've shot a lot of stuff with my 6.5. I probably shouldn't. Like, I've shot a couple of moose with it and some bears, some bigger bears, like, just cause I'm so confident. I shoot it so fast and you can see your shots just so stinking good because it just doesn't kick.
Yeah. So at the point you're selecting, your round and your caliber, you've already decided whether you want to reload or whether you want to shoot box ammo, right? You have to make that decision.
I'm reloading and just cause I mean, I'm set. I reload a lot. I mean, I've reloaded. Yeah. I don't even want to think of how many rounds I've reloaded. So I've got a big room full of a billion presses and just, anyway, I do all that. So yes, in it's been awesome the last few years. And I think the reason the 6.5 PRC, the 7 PRC, the 300 PRC has done well is because Hornady's doing a pretty good job. We've shot up, set up a bunch of guns with guys like, hey, I want to shoot factory ammo. So we'll get a few different lots of 6.5 PRC or 7 PRC, and they shoot pretty good. So that's a good thing to bring up. It doesn't really enter my head because I just know I'm going to reload. But yeah, if you're going to reload or if you're going to buy factory, I would probably lean towards those rounds right now because Hornady's doing a pretty good job, pretty affordable, pretty good bullet choice, high BC, longer range bullets. And they've been good. I mean, 6.5 PRC has been real accurate.
Yep.
So
yeah, that's kind of like I say, you know. And then do you also, I mean, we've had some discussions about 300 PRC versus 7 and what your target animal or like what the gun's primarily going to be used for. So if, you know, for an elk guy or a moose or elk guy primarily versus if you're just going to be a mule deer hunter, like how do you, like, is there an energy idea? Is there just like your experience on terminal performance on game? Like, how do you decide, like, all right, I want to be able to shoot this gun out to 800 for elk, or I want to be able to shoot this gun out to 600 for deer. Like, how does that weigh in on your final, you know, and maybe you don't think of that as much as maybe the guy that's wanting to buy, a different guy wanting to buy a gun should think about it.
Yeah. So there's the 1,000 foot-pounds of energy on impact. There's all kinds of different theories out there. I am a big fan of, less so now, but I think overkill is always better. Some of my stuff is anecdotal. I don't want to talk bad about 7 mils, but back in the day, I had a 280 Ackley, and I won't say what bullet I was using. It wasn't a Burger, but I was using some bullets and had some real bad experience on elk. It's an accurate round. 7 mils are awesome. I mean, there's a lot of good 7 mils out there. We had 2 Rosies and 1 Rocky that we shot with that gun in 1 year. And it was really, really bad performance. So that's pretty anecdotal. There's a lot of different bullets. Some of the bullet placement was all bullet placement was good. It should have been adequate. You could say not perfect. It wasn't a double lung heart shot, but it was in the vitals. It broke bone. And so since then, like, I've shied away from it. So if I'm going to go elk or moose, I'm going to default to the 30 almost always. I've had really good luck with the 215, the 230 Burger, and even the 245, you know, the 212 ELDX. Like, there's a lot of bullets that guys have had really good luck with. So I want a little bit more impact. That being said, I shot a Shires this year with a 6.5 PRC and dropped it. It was quick. It was a 300 yard shot and dropped it fast. So, I think more energy is better. I like a bigger hole. I think it's not just energy. I feel like, man, 338s and 30s seem like they kill really good. And I don't, maybe it's subjective, but it seems like diameter. And a lot of guys I talk to that shoot a lot of elk always seem to like 30s more than 7s. So personal preference, but I like 30s.
Yeah. And then like my 338, and I don't want to get into nerd out on it completely. Yeah. Like those big 300 grain pills and like just a sectional density of those. They don't. 100%. And it's my family growing up, like, oh, you're going to have no meat left. And I'm like, I've killed elk with 243s and I've skinned your guys out that have 270 holes in them. Like the sectional density and the construction of this bullet, like you can eat to the hole versus your guys' little bullets that explode. Like, don't give me the 243, 270 doesn't waste any meat. Like the sectional density, the hole, like I always get an exit out of those 300 grain burgers because there's so much energy to go through. And so that plays into it a lot, in my opinion, as well.
I shot coos deer with my 338, 300 grain bullets, and it's 338 in and it's a quarter out and you're done. I've shot them with some smaller guns and it's a little hole in and 6 softball out the other side. So, I mean, again, hitting bone, things change. You guys know that. But I love 338s are awesome. I can't spot the shot generally in the weight I want to carry on all these backpack hunts we do. Yep. Like, I'm just not willing to do that right now, weight wise, because I've been packing camera gear. All my gear weighs too stinking much.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm trying to cut some weight somewhere, and it seems like I go down to that 6.5 PRC or a 30 cal.
Yep, gotcha. So.
Oh.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at OReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's OReillyAuto.com/meateater. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
We've got, I mean, you build your rifles, you've had lots of rifles built for you over the years. Like, how important, with all the technology out there and everybody building pretty good stuff, like, how important are the triggers and barrels and bedding and stocks? Like, all these things are, you know, when you go to build a gun, you pick the barrel, you pick the stock, you pick, you know, and then the bedding's a little bit of the art and the gun builder and making sure that's done right. But in your opinion, how important is that stuff when you go to build a gun, or should you just go with what your builder recommends, or what, you know, if I'm coming to Mountain Forge
if you have a good builder, trust what they say, you know. We've done everything from, you know, a lot of the chassis say they're drop and ready, bolt and go, and I've had great luck with that. I also like bedding. I've also epoxied them together. I'll do that too. I love that. I know there's no variables. And so triggers are important. Use the best trigger. Like, I think the top triggers right now are Trigger Tech, which is what I run, and Bix and Andy's making some real good triggers. Barrels, I've seen every company there is make bad barrels. But there's the top, there's, you know, you've got Benchmark, Krieger, Bartland, Proof. There's a whole bunch of good barrel makers. I'm leaving a bunch out, but if they're a name in barrels, they're generally going to be fine. And everyone has made a bad barrel. It's the way it goes. I've seen every scope break there is. I've never seen a single brand not break. You just want to pick stuff that's got a pretty good reputation and it's tough. And so, yeah, I think all those components play together. They're important to me. I think there's a lot of custom rifles out there. In my opinion, I'll bet 80 to 90% of them aren't being utilized. The load development's not done. People don't, their chronos are different. They're switching lots of powder and they're not rechecking their gun or re-zero. And they're switching lots of bullets, lots of brass, their barrels wearing. Some people don't know that barrels speed up. Like a barrel's going to speed up at 50 to 100, 150 rounds. And it's going to speed up 20, 50, 70 feet a second. And they just get their load done in 20 rounds. And then they go hunting. A year or two later, like, why am I missing high or what's going on? So stuff changes. I check my guns all the time before every single hunt. I chrono and shoot at least to 600. But stuff changes. But yeah, get the best components you can get. But the setup, there's a lot of good guns out there that aren't being utilized correctly. So, and that comes from guys geeking out on it, being a hobby, learning, and getting their guns set up correctly.
Gotcha. Now we'll go into the optics, and we talked about all the gun components. Yeah. Now, maybe just as important, if not more important, or what you're going to, you know, glue to the top of the gun or stick to the top of the gun, you know? And so what's your opinion? How do you approach optics? You know, you're mounting, like, is there a best way to mount? Are there multiple ways? And then ultimately, what are you looking for in an optic on top of your gun?
Yeah. So the whole lapping of rings and stuff, in my opinion, shouldn't be necessary. I've never done it. If you're using a good action with a straight rail and good rings, they better be straight. So I've never lapped any rings. I've never had any problems with the scope. So I don't think that you can ignore some of those things that used to be a lot more commonplace when guys lapped rings, when receivers were crooked and rails were out of spec and stuff like that. So I think that element is mostly gone. So I use good rings. Knife Force makes great rings. I like the Loophole Mark IV rings, Hawk. There's a lot of good rings out there, guys. So use good rings. Don't skimp on that. Don't make sure I love actions with integral rails, you know, machined into the action. If they're not, take those screws out, clean them with alcohol, use Loctite. You do not want your rail coming loose. I can't tell you how many guys have brought, John, I'm in a jam. Can you come check my gun out before season? I got to hunt next week. And so they run over to the house. We'll go up. I was like, yeah, everything good. Yeah. Everything's tight. Everything's tight. I was like, okay, we go up there and shoot four rounds. It's all over the place. And I was like, hey, your scopes, you know, pull the scope off, check the screws, they're all loose. And so that happens a lot. So just common sense, guys, you can't assume. You got to pull everything apart, clean it, Loctite it, and then redo it. You don't need to Loctite your cross bolts on your rings, torque those. Most of them are 55 pound on the cross bolts, 55 inch pounds. And then follow your torque specs for your caps. They're usually pretty good. You can use blue Loctite in your caps if you want, but just make sure it doesn't move. The biggest hang up I see with guys getting it, and I don't know if hang up's the right word, but they're hesitant to spend the money they need to on a scope. I would much rather see a guy shoot a $500 gun with a $2,000 scope than a $3,000 or $4,000 rifle with a $500 scope.
Yep.
So all day long, I mean, I've had broken scopes. I've had scopes that don't track, and it is, you're not going to hit what you're not going to hit anything. You're not going to be consistent. You're not going to be able to figure out your drops. Nothing's going to make sense. So spend the money on a good scope. I would say at least $1,500 and scopes go up to $4,500 or more. I mean, some of the ZCOs and the Tangents, I don't know how much those are now, but they're a lot.
Yeah.
But if you're in that, you know, that Loophole Mark V range, Knife Force NXA, Knife Force Attacker. I know guys, some of the guys are liking the Trigicon, the 10 mile, I think. There's a lot of good scopes out there. But spend the money on a scope.
Yeah,
Don't skimp on a scope. I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, but there's some scopes out there that you need to spend more money on if you can. I understand there's budgets and there's stuff, but if you can afford a, you know, if you can afford a big truck payment, buy a nice scope.
And with that said, I think we both hunt with the same rifle, right? You're a Mark V guy on your hunting rifles, and aren't they on your competition guns as well?
Yep.
Okay, and then I've got Mark V's on two, my 7 SOM and my 338 Edge, and then I shoot the VX6 4-24 on my 6.5 PRC.
Okay.
Cool. So I did switch.
I haven't shot those enough. I get questions about those, the VX5 and 6HDs, and I just haven't messed with them enough.
Yeah.
I've heard some decent things about them. I know they're light.
Yep.
I just am so reliant on. I just want the most durable scope.
Yeah.
I had a hard time. I think I've said this before. Like, I had shot Loophole years and years ago, and I had switched to Knife Force just because they were tanks, and it was the old Loophole Mark IV, no zero stop. This is a long time ago. And then I was talking with Riza over at Loophole, and she wanted me to shoot for them. They said, you know, the Mark V's coming out. And I was pretty hesitant because I didn't love the Mark IV, to be honest. And so I've gained a lot of trust in the Mark V over the years. I beat that first one up, like tried to break it, just I dented it. I dented the objective. I beat the crap out of it, and it held up, and they've held up really good. I've had some big drops on hunts. I've had big drops on competitions and I haven't had any issues with them. I've grown to trust them a lot. I'm
a nerd, so I'm always doing research. And the one thing the PRS does is it always shows you like what scope are the top 100 shooters using, what triggers, what barrels. And so I went back to, I think it was like 2018, and you go back and it's like US Optics. and I don't know if you get all the credit for this or if it's a group of you guys, but you go back to like 18, 19 before the Mark V was released, and you're like, oh, Leupold has like two shooters. Yeah, two shooters, and they might be in the 50 to 100.
No, those two shooters were industry partners that got a free invite to the finale. Those people were. And they were running the Mark 8s back in the day.
Yeah.
So and nobody was running them. It was, and now it's crazy.
Yeah, I pulled it up the other day. I think it was December 1st. I remember because I was talking to Dirk and I pulled it up. I said, well, what's everybody in 23 using? And you go there and it's like 70% of the shooters are now using the Mark V, which it's kind of cool to see that change. So, I mean, you know, the top shooters in the world are now trusting that Mark V is going to do what it's supposed to do and what you've proven it can do. So that's pretty cool. When you guys were relying on that thing to return to zero perfectly and that every click is as close to one as you can get, it's probably never going to be 1.00, but it could be one.
I have a tracking board at my house. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Or, I mean, it's splitting hairs, but you could be 0.9997, which is all, And so, I mean, that thing's as dialed as, I walk mine around 20 MOA at 100 just to make sure it shoots a square and comes back to zero. And the thing's been super repeatable and never off track.
100%. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I do the same thing. I have a big, like 14-foot tall board. I track test. I put scopes on this big, this 50-pound steel thing with a pick rail, and I've track tested a ton of scopes, and I've had them all be good. I had an early prototype one that was a little bit off, but that wasn't for sale. And every production Mark V I have is tracked really well. I hear things on the internet, guys, like, "Hey, do you really trust the Mark V? I read this on the internet," and I'm like, "Man, I haven't seen it. I do trust it." That being said, Night Force makes an awesome scope. There's other companies that make great scopes, but I do like the Mark V. I think the balance for the cost, I don't want this to be a sales pitch, whatever, but the cost, the weight, and the performance is pretty good. It's pretty, the locking elevation, and then I like the cap windage. Yeah. If you throw your gun to scabbard on a horse hunt or something, like it's a pretty durable scope.
Yeah. So that was one thing that crept up and bit us on my dad's 300 Ultra Mag. We were in Colorado on a deer hunt and it doesn't have capped windage, and somewhere along the way it got off and he missed a shot at a great male deer at like 300, not even a long range shot, but his windage had got turned so much that it put him off. And so that's another,
I love a cap windage.
And then I'm pretty excited. Maybe I don't want to sound too sales pitchy, but I know the day that this podcast launches, Leupold's kind of following up their Mark V with a new Mark IV HD, which will be kind of in that same realm. Prices, I'm not going to even get into the prices because I don't know per model, but like really, really attractive for, you might be able to change your idea that you need to spend X on a scope, because it sounds like we might get an option that's, we have to do some more testing, but
I don't know a ton of what I can, talk about, but it's going to be, you guys will see it. The Mark IV, it looks very, very similar to a Mark V, a little different tube size. I think we talked about they're going to a 34 on them instead of a 35 on a bunch of them, but it's going to be cheaper. They're taking a lot of the tech out of the Mark V. It's going to, from what I've seen, the ones I've played with, it's pretty impressive. And again, I'm not one to say I never recommend something until I use it a lot. But from what I've seen so far, it looks pretty impressive. So price points are going to be really good. It's not a replacement for a Mark V. It's going to be, it's kind of the tier below. And I think, we'll see improvements to the Mark V is probably due for a revamp at some point. So I think it'll be the Mark IV, then, we'll just keep going and progressing. Yeah. So it's cool. When you guys see it, you'll laugh. It looks, they did a little tiny subtle changes to the turrets, but it looks like a Mark V. It's a sexy little scope.
Yeah. So I'm excited.
They changed it. Instead of like a 525, it's a 624 type of range. So they changed that a little bit to a 4X, but it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Excited about that. Now let's go into issues you might. So you've got your gun built now, we've got our optics mounted, we're all dialed in there. Like, what issues could pop up? What if the gun builders did, like, what have you found? The first things,
everything,
but like, what's the most probable issue, and like, where should you start?
I've seen so many weird things that I can't even, I've had good brass from companies that I, instead of testing and measuring everything, I just trust to open it up, size it, check the necks and rock and roll, and have issues with internal volumes that throw weird stuff off. One of the weirdest ones lately is I was fighting a carbon barrel gun. And it was like, I'd get some good groups and some bad groups. It just wasn't as consistent as I would like it to be. And I fought. I took it out. I checked, just redid. I can't remember. I changed the bedding. I changed stocks. I changed scopes. I changed everything. I went, changed bullets. I changed powders, and I could not figure it out. The last thing I did was I pulled the muzzle brake off to just triple check that it was clean. It wasn't carboned up. And it wasn't. And I was like, screw it. I'm going to put on a different brake. So I had a really lightweight, a titanium brake that was really light. And I just threw on one of my comp brakes. And so I went from like a 1 ounce or a sub 1 ounce brake to an 8 ounce brake, I think it was, just because I was going to throw the gun away. And I put that other brake on and the gun just shot like, I don't know, I don't want to say quarter inch because that's whatever, but I had 3/8 consistently. And I went from an inch and a half to just sub half inch, just switching the brake, and it stacked at 100. And I was like, okay, I'm running a heavy brake on this gun. And it just, whatever the deal was with the harmonics in that barrel, the weight off the end of it just settled it down. And that's what a lot of guys, the weight of a suppressor or weight of a brake will change things. So that's just one example of things I've seen. I've seen so many different things, but I can't really say it, you know, pick one. But generally, if you're going to work on a gun, I shot Hodges and powders a lot. I like the extreme lines. I like, you know, 4350, H1000. I like a lot. Rotumbo went away for a long time. I haven't shot Rotumbo in years, and I didn't like it as much. I did get some weird pressure spikes with Rotumbo back in the day that I didn't with H1000. 4831, Varget, all those powders are great. There's a lot of good powders. So go with trusted components, good brass, good bullets. Try to eliminate as many variables as you can so you don't question things if there's an issue. Yep. But there's always stuff going on. Like I said, bullets, barrel speeding up, lots of powder changing. I've seen a lot of speed differences in powders the last handful of years since COVID. I don't know if everyone's manufacturing is stress and everything. And I feel like the lot-to-lot variance was bigger than it used to be. So if you guys are, you got 3 pounds of this and you run out and you go buy an 8 pound of this, it's the same powder, check your speeds, pressures most likely will be different. Some real basic stuff, but a lot of things people overlook. And even do some measurements when you switch lots on bullets. So yeah. I try to buy big lots of stuff so I don't have to do that. Like if I can buy like 40 or 50 pounds at a time of powder, I don't have to worry about that as much.
Yep.
I try to do that, but
I need you.
I'm also going through a lot.
I need you to explain that to my wife, why I needed 32 pounds of H1000 and RL26 at the same time, was to make sure that there wasn't any lot, you know, variation. And
And you got to protect her when the world ends. You got to have a stock.
Yeah, there you go. But like you talked about good powders, like my H1000, like my ES, my spread on 338 edge is like single digits on the edge. Yeah. And whether it's hot or cold, where we tried to chase a little bit more performance with the RL26, but I tell you what, if I go out and shoot that gun at 80 degrees here and then go out and shoot 100%. It at 30, I'm like, it wasn't worth chasing the speed. You know, I don't know if you've messed with Vitavori seems to have like a little more of that performance edge, but a lot more temp stable. And so we're doing some switching around even in my own loads. But yeah, that was one thing. My RL26 did switch lots in between like my first load versus like this new load. Mm-hmm. And I could not, the gun was, you know, literally dropping primers out the back, not even just like ejector marks and sticky bolts, like dropping primers when I'm like, oh, that primer fell out. And like when I was here, like it was shooting well. And then we had to go back and like move everything on that load. Like the powder changed, how deep we were seating the bullet to get the pressures to get in the right spot. And then now the gun shoots lights out again. But one thing we didn't talk about, which we don't even have that much time, is like when you get a good rifle built, you know, and you've built it backwards from a bullet, because that's going to have to, you know, getting way into the deep end, like where you're going to chamber the gun, how far out you're going to push that bullet and try to be in, you know, out of the lands and all of that. I've been amazed. Like one thing that really kind of made me like open my eyes is just how finicky it is with tenths of grains of powder and bullet seating and the balance of that. 'Cause you might have a gun that shoots, you know, quarter MOA as long as you're doing your job. But if you don't get that node just perfectly and get your bullet seated right or get the right amount of powder and get that all to match in, you might have a gun that's shooting, you know, 3/4 to 1 MOA on the same gun that you just bump things a little bit and it just seems to dial it in. Was one thing that's like, wow, I didn't realize it mattered that much.
Yeah, I think I don't, honestly, I don't know if it does. If you take a 338 and you're running or whatever, if I take my Norma and I'm running whatever, 85, 84 grains, whatever it happens to be, if I'm shooting 84 grains and I go to 83.8, so 2/10 less, and you go shoot a 3-shot group, maybe that group looks tighter on that group, but it's not going to look tighter over a sample of 50.
Yeah.
It's just, it's too small of a percentage to change.
So what percentage,
I don't think it does.
What percentage do you think matters? If you start to move a half a grain of powder, does it start to?
So in the bigger guns, I generally do bigger jumps. And if I'm having problems, I will shrink down, but I don't think it matters as much. I think what I've been doing more lately is I try to stay anywhere away from pressure because they can get finicky. And like when you said about dropping primers out the bottom, you guys need to be careful when you're on really, like I live in Western Oregon, you grew up Western Washington, it gets really wet and water causes pressure. So this is like a disclaimer outside your question, but if you're anywhere close to pressure under good conditions and you're pouring down rain and everything's soaking wet, you're going to pressure out really hard. So you guys can do water tests. You can pour out water on your ammo, feed it, shoot a couple rounds, get that chamber wet and see if you still are pressure free. So that's just a tip that you got to be pressure safe with water.
Yep.
So going back to the other thing, what I do, I've been doing more lately is I generally will know there's enough information or I've shot enough calibers where I know there's a speed node for different calibers. For whatever reason, like my 6.5 PRCs, depending on barrel length, it seems like 2900 to 2930, 2940 with the 156 is a really, really good speed accuracy wise. And so I generally, what I've been doing lately, it's been working pretty good, is I'll experiment a little bit with powder and maybe half grain increment, some bigger jumps. And then I'll hit that speed. I'll just load to 2920 and then I'll do seating test jumps. I'll go 20, 50, 80, 120. Like I'll do big seating depth tests and kind of make some corrections off of that. That will change your speed a little bit. The bigger the closer you are to the lands, with your bullet loaded, your pressure is going to spike real quick. And that's like back in the day when Weatherby got all that speed, they just had massive freeboard built into their guns. So they get a bigger running start with that bullet, slam it into the lands, and you can get more speed that way. You can load more powder, all that stuff. So your speeds will change as you get closer and further away from the lands. But I've been doing some testing that way, and it's been working pretty good. Kind of tuning a load with seating depth.
Gotcha.
I don't – in the small guns, like when I'm shooting my dashers a lot, when you're loading 30 grains and – 29 and a half or 31 grains. Like I'll do the 0.2, 0.3 grain increments. But if your gun is going to change, like I don't want my gun to change if I load a 10th or two either way. I don't think it's going to. I think over a big sample size, it's not going to. If you go shoot a 20 round string or a 10 round group, you shoot a 5 shots and 5 shots and 5 shots, letting your barrel cool, whatever. I don't think your groups are going to be that much different. I think they're all going to kind of cluster into either a 1/2 inch or a 3/4. Gotcha. The whole quarter minute gun idea, God, that's bench rest territory. Once in a while, I get a gun that seems to do that. But that's when people say quarter minute, if I do my part, I just call BS 90% of the time.
It's just a real rare gun to do that.
Yeah. And it's just in a light Magnum, I just don't. The shootability of those is difficult. If you're in a bench rest gun, I get it. I'm not arguing with bench rest guys, the guys that shoot the PPCs and the 100-yard bench rest and then different things like that. Like those guys are shooting tiny, tiny groups, but that's a different thing than we're talking about. We're talking about hunting. We're talking about field. We're talking about position in the field that's not ideal. You know, if you could shoot 1/2 inch, 1/2 MOA all day, you're killing everything everywhere. You're not missing anything. So, I mean, if you can extrapolate that all the way out, you're shooting 2.5 inches of 500 and 5 inches of 1,000, you're not missing anything anywhere. Yeah. And so I want slow and steady, consistent day in and day out. I don't want big flyers. I don't want pressure spikes. I don't want to be anywhere near my pressure limit, which if guys are shooting, reloader powders have been really, really accurate for me. But generally, those are the guys chasing speed. They're grabbing 16, 26, 33. And even the VIT powders are the same thing, the 565s and the 570s and the big Magnums. those guys are chasing speed. And I'm not that guy anymore. Like, I'll test them, and if they shoot great, great. But they have been more finicky. I feel like the bit powder's carbon up more than Hodgson. They're way dirtier. Same with Reloader. I just haven't had as good as experience with them.
Gotcha. So, yeah, like I say, there, it's obvious through this podcast, you've got some topics we could go down some giant rabbit holes. We could do a series because there's so much to it. There's so much to it. And, you know, even some of the info that I thought I had, you know, you've got different, you know, where we're doing these little ladder tests at, you know, 0.3 jumps on a 93 grain load of my edge. You're saying didn't matter as much as we thought. It might've just been me shooting that group versus.
I don't want to like rock the boat, but
no, do
if
it.
You're doing one shot ladder tests, I think if you do a bunch of them, if you do the same test three times in a row and check those flat spot, there are nodes, barrels whip, there are speeds that shoot better. Like I said earlier, it seems like I've like 29, 20 and 40 with the 6.5 PRC and 156. It seems like they shoot there a lot. There are different nodes. So I'm not arguing that. And in theory, the ladder is supposed to show those nodes, right? But I've also, you've got extreme spreads, you've got your brass prep, your consistency. If you shoot that same test 3-4 times, and so it's 30 or 40 rounds and you overlay all that data, I'm okay with that. But when guys go out and shoot one round once and like there's a flat spot, I call BS on that. Like I've tried it, I just don't do it.
Yeah.
It's good info. It's good to have. I just think the statistical relevance of it isn't near as significant as people think, unless you have bigger data samples.
Yeah.
So some of the best shooters, one of my buddies, like Jake and Morgan, those guys are kind of, like Morgan's top of the game right now. He's a great shooter. I travel with him a lot, and he's like, he just goes and shoots 10 and 20 round groups. And he goes, if it's 5/8, whatever, he goes, I'm going to win a match. He goes, he doesn't even hardly do load development anymore. 6.5 Creed with a 150 class bullet running at 2680 to 2700 feet a second. It's going to shoot there. You know, if it doesn't, it's the barrel's problem. That's kind of his mentality. I geek out a little more than that, but it's when you shoot a lot of big data sets, your little 1 2/10 tweaks start to go away and it gets frustrating. You're like, oh wait, this is kind of meaningless because I shot 1 3-shot group here and I shot another 3-shot group. You know, you need big data samples.
Yep. Gotcha.
So talking in circles a little bit here.
Yeah, no. It's great information. So. And you know, it's like same thing on the archery side where we used to all paper tune. And now I'm to the point where, you know, depending on the bow, you get it set and I'm just going to get my broadheads and field points to match in. And I, you know, we skip paper sometimes. So there's different ways to get there where you're just focusing in on that speed that, you know, from so many, you know, trigger pulls and chrono checks that you're like, I'm going to get the gun there and then mess with seating and we should be good. Which sounds like
that was worked a lot.
Yeah. No. And that's where
I change powder. The guys are like, oh my gosh, you know, but you know, you do tweak powder, but just, if I get to know a gun a lot, like I've shot a lot of 6-dashers, 6.5 Creeds, 25 Creeds, 6.5 PRCs, 300 Normas. There's a lot of guns I've shot a lot. And it just seems like I started all that with, you know, 3/10 and half grain increments and up and down and seating depth. And it just seemed like every gun kept coming back to a general ballpark. And that's why I'm saying that. I started with the powder thing, you know, but I have changed a little bit over the years. A little less time too. It's like, hey, I know it's going to get here. Let's get here as fast as we can. Do a big seating depth test and try to do bigger sample sizes. You know, I'll shoot a 3-shot group with magnums. I don't want to shoot a 10-round string, right? I'll do that with my comp guns and shoot like a 10-round group and just see how it goes. But with magnums, I'll shoot 3, let it cool, shoot 3, let it cool, shoot 3. So I'll have 9 shots in a group or something like that. And I want it to stay in there. You know, I don't want big flyers, but if you're shooting 1/2-inch, like I'm pretty happy with that, especially in the light guns.
Gotcha. So, thanks for coming on, John. We really appreciate having you. You're a wealth of knowledge. Sure. You know, you shoot great. Your knowledge is goes deep into the topic of long range guns, shooting really well. And I love more so that you're not just a steel puncher, that you did all this because you love to hunt and then you like to go take what you know and to you know, put it into animals. So do you have any big plans for 2024 that you're putting together?
I mean, we're working on it. There's a bunch of connections. We're probably going to go back up to the territories this year, kind of finalizing that for doll sheep. Maybe caribou on a trophy fee. I'm trying to finish my North American 29. I was up at Kodiak, was number 27 in December. I went up there and killed a pretty good blacktail up there. And so that was number 27. So I have got a polar bear left and a Rocky Mountain bighorn. And so kind of working through that, maybe polar bear this spring. There's a lot of stuff that's not in concrete that we're working on. So gotcha. Yeah, there's some hunts coming up. So we'll see kind of how things work out. Some of it comes down to raffle drawings and some luck and some other things. So
yeah,
so we'll see. And then blacktail, like I love blacktail hunting around here when time permits. Like, it was fun. This year was fun. They bumped the Oregon season dates back this year to like, it ran to November 10th. And so I got back from the finale and I had 5 days to hunt, which was awesome. So
nice.
I was running around with my rifle and passed on more big blacktails than I've ever passed looking for a giant, but didn't shoot one, but I had a blast. Saw some big bucks at 200-300 yards that you normally wouldn't see because of the dates. So that was a lot of fun.
That's cool.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll fit something in, and there's always hunts that come up last minute. So
you're going to bring that 6.5 PRC up there for the polar bear? You're going to grab a bigger gun? You think so?
Maybe bring the six dasher up there for the bear. No, I'll probably just bring a 30. I'm assuming probably just the 300 Norma. So I was actually going to talk with a guy. We might actually shoot with solid just to test. Generally up there, I've been up there once before for my buddy Ben's hunt in November. And, it's generally not long. It's not a really long range hunt the way it lays out. It's an interesting deal. So I might take solids up there as a test. So we'll see.
Cool. Well, how can all our listeners follow along? I know you're not, you know, you're all over the PRS and the NRL stuff, and there's articles and all the shooting support that you get, but you don't seem to be huge on social. But it is there.
I just have mostly just Instagram. I so far behind, I didn't post on half my stuff this year. I have a mostly a hate relationship with social. I like seeing other people's hunting stuff, so I need to post more. So I'll be posting stuff on there, but it's just John Pinch on Instagram, JONPYNCH. And I'm blocked, so you got to search me to find me. I posted this picture of, I was up in Alaska we were on a bear hunt this year, and I shot a harlequin. I posted a picture of that with a over under, and my profile is banned for nudity because of that duck picture.
Really?
I was like, what? And anyway, so there you go. That's where I'm at. But follow along, post pictures of mostly hunting stuff, a little bit of comp stuff, but reach out, shoot me a message if I can help you. Well, generally respond on Instagram relatively quickly. But if you have any questions, more than happy to help you guys with what I can.
Appreciate chatting with you. Usually our conversations are, John, I got, something's not going right with this load or this gun or it's nice to sit down and have a chat about everything shooting, and not even everything, like barely scratch the surface on everything shooting. You could probably talk for days, but appreciate having you. Good luck on all your hunts this year, John, and we'll stay in touch.
Yeah, thanks. You too. Thanks for having me on, man.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.